Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Robert Wistrick, Neuberger Professor of History and Director of the Vidal Sassoon International Center for the Study of Antisemitism at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Since it's in the nature of academics to squabble, it's rare when there is consensus on the foremost scholar in a field. But when it comes to the issue of antisemitism, there's agreement that no one today has the same depth and breadth of knowledge as Professor Robert Wistrick. Recently publishing his 30th book, a massive summa that encompasses a lifetime of scholarly engagement with the topic, Wistrick's latest monograph is titled From Ambivalence to Betrayal, Israel, the Jews, and the Left. Robert, I'm so glad to have you on Counterpoint to talk about it.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Robert, you open Ambivalence and Betrayal with a vignette about your own biography and how it led you to this topic. So tell us a little bit about your upbringing.
Well, I was born in what was once considered to be the socialist paradise. It was one of those accidents of history, although it wasn't really an accident. My parents, who were Polish-born from 1939, from the first day of the outbreak of World War II, fled from their hometown of Krakow, eastwards, and ended up in Lvov, or Lviv as it's known today, a few days after the Red Army actually conquered and annexed eastern Poland as part of the Nazi-Soviet Pact agreement. And as a result of that, they spent the next 7 years involuntarily as citizens of the Soviet Union. And eventually, in 1942, they arrived in Kazakhstan, a Muslim republic of the Soviet Union. And I was born there at the end of World War II. Subsequently, they were repatriated, that was the term, at the end of 1946 to Poland. And they discovered something they didn't know previously, that Poland had become a mass cemetery for the Jewish people as a result of the Holocaust. And in 1948, as communism was taking over Poland, they managed to escape the country at the last minute. And eventually, after a period in France, they came to the United Kingdom, where I grew up, where I was educated, first at Cambridge University, later at University College London.
And from there, then, you went to actually for a stay in Israel. You became involved with a journal called New Outlook that was begun by Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher. And New Outlook introduced you to a whole series of different leftists in Israel, as well as to a wider conversation that was going on in the left about the Arab-Israeli conflict. How did that influence your take on the issues you discuss in the book?
Well, it's certainly true that my experience as a rather young editor for 9 months of this journal, New Outlook in Tel Aviv, that was an important aspect in my choosing subsequently, a year or two later, the topic of my doctoral dissertation. But it wasn't the only factor. You have to remember that in my family, given the fact that they had experienced 7 years of real communism in the Soviet Union, that my father had been twice imprisoned and had tried to commit suicide the second time, after arrest by the NKVD, the secret police. Obviously, I was aware in a more visceral way of the implications of communist totalitarianism. Secondly, at school and then at university, I was radicalized like many people in the late 60s and actually participated, albeit briefly, in the Paris student revolt, and also during a period in the United States when the campuses, I think, were literally coming apart in 1967-68 with the background of the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because on the one hand, it sounds like horrendous experiences that your father and, as a result, your family went through under communism. And at the same time, you're talking about becoming a part of this Marxist, left, radical student movement in the 1960s. How did those two things come together for you?
I see it primarily, and even more in retrospect, as a generational revolt. I felt part of a generation. And it was a protest against everything that was considered as the established order from the mid-1960s onwards. And remember, I was just in my early 20s, and I felt that that order, which existed in Britain and in America and in Europe, that it was passé. On the other hand, the alternatives were not clear. The atmosphere was a rather utopian sort of Marxism. and the particular philosophy that attracted me, albeit briefly, in 1968, was called Situationism, which was very much a minority taste, but quite influential in student circles.
So, Robert, now let's turn more specifically to the book. I know that you struggled with the title of the book. Can you unpack why it's a fitting label for the larger argument that you make? Why From Ambivalence to Betrayal?
Well, in the course of my research of attitudes of the socialist movement in particular in Europe from around the 1840s until the First World War, which was the topic of my dissertation, I felt that there were two seemingly contradictory strands. One was that socialists, by and large, on principle, opposed anti-Semitism, not because of any deep empathy or understanding of Jews, which most of them singularly lacked, but rather because socialism saw itself as a continuation and a completion of a general emancipatory trend. Something that began with the French Revolution, that was taken on board by European liberalism, and the socialists were taking it a stage further. The emancipation of the working class was to be the final stage, and this had a broad, universal, humanist aura. So it'd be very hard to embrace anti-Semitism, formally at least, within that framework. However, when you look into the detail, you discover that many of the leading figures in European socialism, and even in British socialism, were in fact very much afflicted with all kinds of anti-Jewish prejudices. This was true of Karl Marx. It was true of the founder of anarchism in France, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, of many of the French utopian socialists. It was true of the British left at the end of the 19th century, even in Germany, which was relatively immune on the social democratic left, there were such currents. So the ambivalence is, how did these people reconcile a general philosophical agenda, which does not really go together with anti-Semitism, with the fact that a whole range of issues, their personal attitudes and the cultural embedment of that was in fact very much part of the environment in which they grew up. So there was this dissonance and this tension, and I think it's carried through. The betrayal aspect about which I hesitated really belongs to the last 30, 40 years in my eyes. I think that what we have seen in terms of what we're broadly for the moment talking about as the left, with all the problematic nature of that kind of sweeping label, that it has lost its way in terms of having a coherent worldview and a set of values which we could truly describe as humanistic and as emancipatory. What I see today is a pattern in which many parts of the left, obviously this varies from country to country, have become not only eclectic, but in many ways do not really have an ideology anymore. So I described it in my book at one point as the floating debris of burnt out galaxies. In other words, there was once a recognizable, identifiable
Marxist galaxy.
Marxist and even non-Marxist socialist frame of reference. And in that framework, although it was far from being idyllic, I think it had its priorities and its values more clearly enunciated. Whereas today we find all kinds of hybrids, which I think are not only unhealthy, but in some cases positively perverse.
And that lead to some of the kinds of alliances that very much worry you. So for example, at the end of the book, you have this chapter about the relationship between Marxists and Islamists in the contemporary context, but we'll come back more to that. Before we get there, let's parse what you've already flagged is one kind of worry in the title of the book. Does it worry you when you speak about the left, since that is a term that has the potential of being quite misleading, since by and large, for example, Democrats in America have a very different viewpoint, including about Israel, whose legitimacy is almost never challenged, than radical leftists around the globe who still hanker for a revolutionary overthrow of the New World Order?
Well, it doesn't really bother me for one reason, that in looking for a title, all authors try to be as concise as they possibly can, at a certain risk of not being able to describe all the different strands that are actually in the text. I think once the reader goes to the text chapter by chapter, he sees that all the requisite, all the necessary distinctions between different currents within the left, in different places, at different times, are fairly clearly expounded. And when I'm talking about anarchists, I make it clear I'm talking about anarchists. When, towards the end of the book, I talk about anti-globalists, it becomes clear what is their position with regard to the issue that is under discussion. When I'm talking about communists, it's absolutely clear what these communists represent, stand for, what they're saying, and it's quite different in most cases, let's say, from a classic social democratic point of view. Now, you raise the issue of America. The truth is that America doesn't feature very much in this book with regard to the left in America. It features more in a kind of negative way insofar as anti-Americanism, particularly in more recent times, has become one of the defining characteristics of a certain kind of left which sees, as it were, all the evils of modernity or globalization as being linked, or imperialism as being linked to American influence. And that equally redounds on the perception, or rebounds on the perception of Israel. So that's the context in which America appears, rather than what actually is the left in America, which is very different, indeed, from that of Europe and other parts of the world. And what you pointed out with regard to Israel, I would accept as being one of the significant differences.
So do you think that it's a fair take on the book to say that insofar as you do speak about the left more broadly and that you're attempting to pull together strands that you see running between these different schools, if you will, or stars within the general galaxy that make up the left more generally, that what concerns you is the betrayal of the contemporary radical left and the ways in which a liberal left too easily capitulates to what you see as a very significant rising tide of anti-Zionism that doesn't speak out against it because it's on the left and not on the right any longer?
Well, let's try and separate a few things here. You've mentioned the rising tide of anti-Zionism. Certainly anti-Zionism, both as an ideology, as a strategy and policies advocated in its wake, is an important theme, particularly in the last third of the book, but it exists in the two previous sections as well, in a different form. I am very critical of the kind of arguments by which this anti-Zionism, sometimes we should put even an inverted commas around that term, is justified. You see, I don't really have a quarrel with people, whether on the left or on the right or in the middle, or apolitical, I don't have a quarrel with people saying, I disagree with the philosophy and the premises of Zionism, I disagree with its consequences, and so on and so forth. That's really not the primary issue for me. What I find in some cases shocking, and in many cases simply irritating and intellectually so unsatisfactory, is when all kinds of labels and amalgams are made in a thoughtless, uncritical and empirically quite easily disprovable way concerning what Zionism is. For instance, it's become fashionable in many quarters in the left. Again, it's not universal, but it's fashionable to lump together Zionism with racism without any further explanation. This is some kind of a given, and we all know what Zionism is, and there's this homogenous concept, and this is racist somehow in its essence, intrinsically. Or the slogan about Israel as an apartheid state that we quite often hear in certain circles on the left, which again, I think is intellectually just would not stand up to any sustained analysis, let alone the outrageous and even slanderous postures, which would say that describe Israel or Nazify it, talk about it as if it was some kind of a Nazi state, which anyone who has any real knowledge of what Nazism was, and certainly what the Holocaust was, could not for a moment take this seriously. And yet this is the kind of vocabulary, the kind of rhetoric that we hear far too often on the left. And that I certainly engage with.
And I do want to talk more about some of these kind of free-floating postulates about Israel as a state and the ways in which these are sometimes bandied about on the left. But before we get there, I think one of the remarkable things about the book is the fact that you put it into this very, very long-term understanding. And I want to parse that with you. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. With me today is Robert Wistrick. We're talking about his newest book, From Ambivalence to Betrayal, Israel, the Jews, and the Left. Now, Robert, this book is really a summa of work that you've done over 40 years on this topic, and as such, it really is an extraordinary distillation. It's mammoth, but also magnificent in what it brings together under its covers. The book goes back to the origins of socialism in the 1830s and 1840s and moves forward to the present. It has three parts. The first part deals with the origin and development of socialism and social democracy, which came to define the European left in the 19th century. Now, it's clear that socialism, as it developed, had a Jewish problem. As an overview on the first part of the book, can you offer us a brief take on how, but also on why, socialism kept tripping over Jews and Judaism on its way to articulating its program of political emancipation?
Let me suggest a number of reasons. First of all, the prime preoccupation of virtually all socialists, whatever the specific school or trend of socialism they advocated, was the development and the future of capitalism. They saw the world through the prism of the development of capitalism. And I think one of the reasons for this tripping over effect that you've evoked is the very simplistic reductionist tendency to identify Jews as a group with capitalism, to see the Jews in the more populist forms of socialism. I would say they simply personified capitalism in Jewish financiers and capitalists, particularly more cosmopolitan Jewish financiers who were supposedly holding the reins of power. They were controlling the levers of the economy. They were responsible, therefore, for the exploitation of workers and peasants, and they were the hidden hand. Now, that is a classic anti-Semitic point of view, espoused very widely on the right and by Catholics in the 19th century in many different places. It's not unique to the left. However, the left being so intensely focused on the evils of capitalism, those socialists who tended to focus attention on Jews naturally are drawn into this outlook. In France, it's stronger probably than anywhere else in the mid-19th century. But you see the young Karl Marx also succumbing, if you like, to this temptation of basically identifying Jews and Judaism in a very reductionist way with the money economy, with exploitation, and blaming Judaism somehow, or even a Judaized Christianity and a Judaized bourgeois society for exploitation. Later, Marx actually, to some degree, frees himself from that, I would say, from that notion. Another reason, I think, is connected with perceptions of religion. We sometimes tend to forget that it, certainly in the 19th century, and it carries through into the last century, how many strands in socialism define themselves atheistically, and they see a major enemy in clericalism. So when they talk about clericalism, they have obviously Christian churches primarily in mind. However, there is a strand of Enlightenment thinking that carries through into socialism, which also sees Judaism, and particularly the Bible itself, as being the source of the authority of the churches, and therefore sees Judaism itself as being implicated in the very kinds of clericalism that they are fighting against. So that's another reason. And then we should add that socialism, in many of its parts, aspired at least to a universalist solution to all ethnic, national, religious problems. So when the Jewish question emerges as a subject of debate, and there's the question of emancipation of Jews that's still not resolved everywhere in Europe, the tendency is to see the Jews as a religious group, not to recognize any national characteristics, and not to see them as having any right to a separate or distinct or autonomous culture.
And that's what preoccupies a lot of the second part of the book, the question of nationalism as it was dealt with by Marxists and social democrats in the 19th century, and specifically Jewish nationalism or Zionism and the way in which they responded to it. Now, with the spectacular success of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, the center of gravity for revolutionaries shifted towards the Soviet Union. As with other aspects of the book, you cover this in several chapters, but just to delimit the discussion, tell us the story of Leon Trotsky, whose tale, as you tell it, embodies the tragedy of Bolshevism when it comes to the issue of Jews and Zionism.
Well, Leon Trotsky was probably the best known, the most colorful, and perhaps the most fateful example of a certain type that we might classify as the international Jewish revolutionist. He was born to a lower middle class Jewish family in the southern Ukraine. His father was actually what was designated later as a kulak, a sort of fairly well-off farmer who worked the land, which wasn't that common among Jews. Trotsky did not have much of a Jewish education, and he quite quickly detached himself from any connections either with the Jewish community, with the Jewish religion, or any kind of social or socializing framework connected with Jews. And he really is an out-and-out internationalist, a consistent internationalist. He sees the future as depending on a permanent revolution that will transcend all national boundaries, religions, ethnic groups, and class struggle in orthodox classical Marxist form as being the driving force of history. In that framework, he adopts what has come to be a standard Marxist view that the Jews, albeit still exist, and particularly in Russia, there were, at the time we're talking about, beginning of the 20th century, there were over 5 million Jews. It was a substantial number. But he was convinced that over time, and as capitalism develops, it will assimilate the Jews, and their distinct characteristics will disappear. So he didn't pay much attention to that. When the Bolshevik Revolution takes place, he rapidly becomes the number two man in the Soviet Union. He also organizes the Red Army and plays a very, very important role in the first 5 years of Soviet rule. At that time, he becomes aware, because of the pogroms, massive pogroms, carried out by counter-revolutionists of the white armies that tried to overthrow the Bolsheviks, that this is anti-Semitism as a weapon. So he's a little more sensitized, but still doesn't take it that seriously. He's not prepared to intervene. However, in the internal power struggle within the Bolshevik Party in the mid-1920s, where he loses out to Stalin, who becomes the dictator of the Soviet Union by the end of the 1920s, Trotsky is cast, as it were, out. And he becomes increasingly a sort of Judas figure. This is the way he's portrayed by the whole Stalinist propaganda apparatus, by the Soviet Union and the communist parties around the world. He wanders from exile to exile. He knows his life is in danger, that Stalin is seeking to find a way to finish him off. It takes time. It actually only happens in Mexico City in 1940. Trotsky then becomes a symbol of opposition to Stalinism, despite the fact that there are some similarities, it has to be said, between his outlook and the Stalinist outlook. But he was a far more sophisticated, many-sided figure, a person of vision, of imagination, who was, you know, familiar with world literature, who took an interest in every new cultural development. Trotsky sensitized in the 1930s to the Jewish question. And what I particularly seek to bring out is that at least he had the capacity, despite his own rather dogmatic internationalist Marxism, to reconsider some of the views that he had held as a younger man. In particular, he recognized that the developments in Nazi Germany had demonstrated that the notion that assimilation would resolve the Jewish question, and it was a question that the whole issue of anti-Semitism would gradually fade away with the consequences of material progress, that this was an illusion. He understood that. If in the most scientifically and technologically developed and intellectually cultivated society in Europe, the Jewish question had been raised to such a paroxysm of hatred, then clearly there was something wrong with this prognosis. Trotsky saw that. He took an interest also, for the first time, in the possibility that Jewish nationalism was legitimate. He didn't give it a stamp of legitimacy, but he did see that in a future socialist order, there must be some kind of possibility for Jews like other groups in a similar situation to have a territorial basis, something he had not considered before. However, he didn't really change his view on Zionism, but it was certainly more flexible than that of his followers, so-called Trotskyists, who are very vocal on this issue to the present day. Because Trotsky, what he did say is this. He felt that in the framework of British imperialism, a declining British imperialism, there was no future for Zionism because the British would betray the Jews at the first opportunity, which is exactly what happened when they slammed shut the gates of Palestine in 1939. Because of their own imperial interests and the desire to appease Arab demand, purely out of imperial realpolitik. Trotsky saw that and he was concerned that this was a blind alley, not because it was inherently wrong, he never stated that. He feared the worst. And that has to be seen in terms of the most dramatic revision that he undertook, and I point this out in the book, in November 1938, just after Kristallnacht in Nazi Germany, a massive nationwide pogrom when the synagogues of Germany go up in flames and 30,000 Jews are thrown in peacetime into concentration camps and Jewish property and shops and businesses are smashed. And this is a shattering event. But Trotsky actually goes on the record saying that we can prophesy, we can predict with absolute certainty that in the event of a new world war, the result will be the physical extermination of the Jews. Now, nobody, to my knowledge, said something like that as clear-cut, as unequivocal, before the outbreak of World War II. And that's why I give it particular attention. And I think it is a stunning, but chilling, obviously, macabre prophecy that actually came true.
So there are actually two sides to the Trotsky story that make it a very illuminating example. One is that Trotsky himself had the flexibility of perspective to understand the changing circumstances in the world and to rethink somewhat his own prior understanding of Jews and Judaism and of the Jewish state in such a way that he came to rethink some of those sorts of issues, something that you say the Trotskyists who followed in that path do not have that same kind of flexibility. And the other thing is that nonetheless, much of his life he spent in denial of his own Jewish roots, and yet he ended up coming to be hunted as the wandering Jew, the Judas figure fleeing from Stalinism. So it's that kind of intellectual flexibility that you point to in the contemporary left that seems to be lacking, a certain dogmatism, especially when it comes to the issue of the Jewish state. You've already pointed to the fact that there are these notions of Israel as a racist state, as an apartheid state, what you call the Holocaust inversion, the depiction of Israelis and of the Jewish state as persecuting Palestinians as if they are the Jews today who are having revisited on their bodies what happened in the context of Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 1940s. Your last book, The Lethal Obsession, another, you know, massive tome, 1,100 pages, a lot of it is preoccupied with the ways in which within the Islamic world, there's very little difference, you suggest, between their anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And it seems a lot of what animates the book is a concern that that line is disappearing in the context of the left today. Why are you worried that these distinctions are being eroded on the part of the left, such that criticisms of Israel are veering into anti-Semitism in a kind of slippery slope that you see as very problematic?
Indeed, more than problematic, but you ask me why am I concerned? Well, let me put my cards on the table. I'm not a member of the left. However, I am not either interested in engaging in some kind of series of accusations of putting the left, with all due skepticism about the term, in the dock. I don't think that that would be a very productive or useful. That would be a polemical book. It's not my primary goal. I'm concerned about it because in any democratic society, a pluralistic society, we need a plurality of opinions. There's a need for the left, even if I don't share their point of view on many issues. So I would want to see a left that at the very least is going to be a little more consistent, more coherent, more faithful to the best values that it has at times in the past represented. And what I see is a sort of disintegration of any kind of real understanding of this particular issue, which to me has high symbolic importance. I think the question of where people stand on Israel tells you a great deal about their broader agendas and perspectives. And when people engage in sometimes wild and even hysterical overstatements with regard to what Israel is and what it does, and choose to take a completely, I would say, one-sided position, and does so with an alarming conformity, something I would not expect from people who define themselves as being critically minded, who place great value on critical judgment and rationality. How is it possible that so many people come to the same conclusion on the basis of rather flimsy evidence and essentialize what Israel and Zionism really is? So that does concern me as a symptom of a wider issue. And because personally, of course, as somebody who has lived in Israel for the last 30 years and is very much aware of the real problems that it faces, aware of its flaws, but also of its achievements, I don't like to see that. And I would like to think, perhaps I'm being naive, but I'd like to think that this book, precisely because it is a serious scholarly study, might contribute something to clearing the air, to let's look at this again. Let's see where it comes from. Let's look at it in the longer durée, as they say in French, in the longer perspective.
Robert, thanks so much for helping us to clear the air on what I really do think is a fraught and a difficult issue for us today, and for consistently insisting upon a certain moral clarity when it comes to the issue of anti-Semitism, not to mention Israel.
Well, let me thank you as well, Jonathan, because it's not often that one is challenged with such incisive questions, which enable one actually to clarify both for oneself and for others what is at stake here.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.